Government Committee, welcome. We are going to take a short recess. We're awaiting some some folks to clear up a little problem we're having with one of our fiscal analysis. And so I just wanted to let you know we are all sort of going to hang out and wait for that for a few more minutes before we come back and go on the record. So we are standing in recess. It makes noise. We have Mr. Steve Bender from the Legislative Fiscal Office on the phone, and we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1066. And Mr. Bender, we had some issues about the fiscal analysis on Senate Bill 1066, specifically, I believe that would be the Dash 7 Amendment.
Yeah.
And it came in at a whopping $300,000, and I've got Ms. Zavala here from the university system to also testify about how they made a mistake. So let's bring Ms. Zavala up at the same time. Mr. Bender, I'm going to have Ms. Zavala explain what they did, and then I will have you do an analysis of what she said and see if we're on the same page. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. For the record, Lisa Zavala with the Oregon University System. And I do apologize. I believe that what our budget office has done is they had not seen or taken into consideration this the provision in the bill for allowing for open seats or available seats. And so they calculated this in terms of revenue that would not have come in the way of tuition. Since then, I just got a voicemail. My budget office wants to talk to me to make sure they fully understand, but I'm here now, and I will guarantee you that once we recalculate that and reconsider that, we will be able to reduce this fiscal impact statement significantly. The other avenue, I believe, that has happened, according to my notes, is that we may have calculated students enrolling in both baccalaureate and master's degree programs simultaneously. And I believe if we recalculate that and consider that they probably won't be, I've never actually knew a student who would do that, I think we can correct that as well.
Okay. So, Ms. Zavala, when you say the fiscal could be reduced significantly, can you give us an idea?
Within the limits allowed by the rules to get this bill out of committee today.
That would be $50,000 or under, would it not?
That would be correct.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Bender, would you please respond to what Ms. Zavala has just testified to?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to do so. I'd also like to just very briefly talk a little bit about our fiscal impact process here at LFO and what we are statutorily required to do. We do, as an initial initial action into to calculate our fiscal impact statements is to contact the affected agencies and to hear from the people who will be running these programs what they think the costs of the programs or the legislation would be and their rationales for those calculations. We did send out copies of the Dash 7 amendments when we received them. I think we received them around noon or so today. To higher ed, to OHSU. I believe we're also sending them out to community colleges. And we haven't heard back from community colleges yet. I think we sent them out a little later than we did to the other institutions. But specifically for the information that we received from the Oregon University System, we did get the numbers or the estimates that Ms. Zavala referenced, and we were immediately concerned with these. We have additional information on how these numbers were calculated, and we had concerns about that as well. We've asked the university system for additional information and to address some of the concerns we had. I do understand that Ms. Zavala is saying that she believes the costs would probably be minimal given the way that you have drafted the language to restrict the requirement for the waiver to cases where there are open seats. And this is what I had expected to see in the fiscal impact and was surprised when that was not the case. There are other aspects of the fiscal impact statement that we are by statute required to include. These include the effects on revenues to the higher education and to OHSU. The revenue impacts we also have some concerns about. Ms. Zavala mentioned one of those, which is we believe that the students are counted twice. But we have additional concerns that she hasn't mentioned that we have also asked for a response from the Oregon University system on. Because of that, we would like to hear back from them before we are able to issue a fiscal impact statement on this particular provision of the bill.
Okay. Okay. Senator Hass has a question.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for your hard work and a couple hours' time. You mentioned community colleges, but in this amendment, they were taken out of the bill, with the exception of one report to the legislature next year.
Yes, we do understand, and okay. We do that interpretation. We do want to see from the community colleges if they believe that there would be costs involved to the colleges to comply with the provisions of this report. We are not necessarily expecting there to be a positive number because we have asked them, but as part of our process, since they are affected by this bill, we did want them to look over this to make sure that we weren't missing anything.
Okay. Mr. Bender, how long will it take you to do a revised fiscal? I suppose that depends on how soon the university system and the community colleges respond, but I know the university system is sitting right in front of me with Ms. Zavala, and community college system is in the room, and so I will just request that that be done by tomorrow morning because I think that can be done. So if you get it by tomorrow morning, when can you have this fiscal analysis done?
Oh, well, we would certainly have it in time for your committee to meet the deadline for dropping the bill at the Senate floor.
Okay, that's exactly where I was headed. I'm glad you saw that because I'd like to pass this bill out, and then if we get the fiscal and it's minimal as we expect, then the Senate president will go ahead and allow it to move to the floor would be my guess. I can't predict what he will do, but that would be my best guess.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I may, I do believe there are other provisions of the bill unrelated to the tuition waiver, which you've been discussing now, that also have fiscal impacts. And I personally am not the staff person here in LFO who has been working on those, but I believe that they will show a fiscal impact, and it is not only the tuition waiver portion that has fiscal implications.
Right, Mr. Bender, that's the talented and gifted portion, and my understanding is that money was already allocated. And Mr. Morgan Allen from the Department of Ed is here to testify to that. So I think we're good to go on that, but I so appreciate you with your keen eyes as to the money. Any other questions from the committee? Anything else from you, Mr. Bender? Any final comments?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, thank you very much for making yourself available by phone. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And how do I
end? Just hit the button. This one, I guess.
Okay. Great. Terrific. Okay, Ms. Zavala, you have your marching orders.
I just received, if you will, Madam Chair, an email from our budget office. It's been updated, so they're ready to submit that to the legislative fiscal office.
Okay, so sounds good to me, committee. We'll get the fiscal by the time the bill's ready to drop, and we'll be all good to go.
Thank you. Again, my apologies for the holdup.
Well, it was just a little bit of a heart thumper there because I know Senator Hass has worked very hard on this, and I've worked really hard with these fine young gentlemen here in the front row, and we really wanted to see this work. So, you know, we're humans. We all make mistakes. A good thing we have the counterbalance system where
yes.
We do the checks and the balances.
Absolutely.
So, all right. Thank you very much.
Senator
Hass, do you want anyone to speak to your amendments, or do you want to just take care of telling us how you've resolved it all?
I think that there's a little chart here that's very quick to go through.
Yeah, why don't you go with that? That's the -7.
But the big question, if you recall, on these amendments was whether to go with a waiver system or a grant structure.
Right.
And it became very clear in our work group and with the chancellor, who said, look, if you want no fiscal impact, you have to go with what he called an open seat waiver, which is it is actually where someone enrolls and takes History 101, and there's a couple of open seats in the back, and that person sits in one of those open seats. Now, it doesn't really work like that, but that's what it's known as, and that's how it was ostensibly going to slip under the fiscal. So that's what's in the bill, in the amendment.
Okay.
There was an issue of whether community colleges should be included. And we thought that they probably should, but the community colleges said, look, you know, that's going to mess up the entire way this is funded, and people in Ways and Means understand the different ways universities are funded versus community colleges. And not only that, we found out that 17 of the 22 community colleges already have programs like this in place, and some are further along than this bill. So community colleges were removed. However, as to encourage them to keep up the good fight, they and the other universities have to submit a report next year to the legislature, which they agreed to do, on how they're helping this particular population of war orphans and widows. The word unemployable was too vague and difficult, and so it was removed. The DVA guidelines under 100% disabled pretty much, we think, takes care of the group that Mr. Thornhill and his guys were looking to take care of. There was no real age requirement. The amendment says you can apply no later than age 24. And this does mean that if you apply for begin at 24, you can keep going till you're 27.
Okay.
But we did draw a line in the sand. How many years can you go? Well, we decided in the work group that the most practical way would be 4 years undergraduate, and in a nod to Senator Morris, 2 years graduate school. And that's based on credit hours, only bachelor's degrees and only master's degrees, no medical degrees.
Okay.
And so in the end, I think we went through this, and one of the ways we wanted to keep this narrow and specific was to do just that, use DVA language and Oregon Student Assistance Commission rules language to keep age and residency requirements and, like I say, make it very, very specific. And with that, all of the parties signed off. I see John here, some of the others are here to testify on this, but I think, with the possible exception of this fiscal question, I think we're good to go.
Okay, thank you. Senator Haas. Senator Morse has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as a point of clarification regarding the age requirement, if a student applies and receives the waiver under this age limitation and then stops out and then comes back at some maybe multiple years later and finishes, would that student qualify for the continued waiver having applied and met the requirement? And as I read that language, I believe it would cover the stopped out student, but I would like to have that maybe clarified.
Okay. We'll have to get Hannah Lay from LC to clarify that.
Is Hannah here? Hannah, oh, there you are. Can you come up, please?
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Hannah Lai with Legislative Council. Chair Walker, Senator Morris, in response to your question, yes, I do believe that somebody could come back at that point after having, if the person had applied before at 23 years of age, had dropped out for a while, they could come back. I see it kind of the waiver for being in two chunks, one being for the baccalaureate, one being for the master's. So, yes, the person could come back.
Oh, thank you. I think it's important to have that clarified on the record. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions that Senator has? Thank you, Ms. Lyon. I hope you'll stay close by. Whenever we have lots of amendments on bills, sometimes we need to have a conversation with LC. All right, thank you. We also, colleagues, have a letter from the Student Assistance Commission that says they are fine with the Dash 7 amendments because they are no longer in vogue. So, Mr. Thornhill and Mr. Wyckoff, why don't you come up and speak to these amendments, if you would? There you go. Thank you. Mr. Wyckoff, why don't you tell us about the community colleges?
Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff, legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association. I'm going to be very, very, very brief today. Just want to say thank you to the committee and especially to Senator Haas for working with us on this issue. We look forward to continuing to implement this program and to be able to better serve veterans on our campuses. But again, we thank you for bringing it to our attention and working with us to implement this in a way that recognizes the longstanding relationship about tuition setting at the local board level. So, thank you very much.
You're welcome. I was pleased to hear Senator Haas say that 17 of 22 community colleges have programs in place, and some of them are even better than what we're offering here.
What we hadn't been asked to do in the past was include folks who had been permanently disabled, mm-hmm. or 100% disabled. So we have not done that. But what the governor had previously asked us to include spouses and dependents of folks who had fallen in combat. Mm-hmm. And so most of our campuses were at some level of implementing that. And then others offer other programs, such as the first 6 credits free to all veterans. And so, this is really core to our mission and something that, we believe in doing. But we have different campuses also approach it different ways. At one mm-hmm. campus, for example, they use a grant program instead of a tuition waiver. And so we believe this allows us the flexibility to work at the same solution but in a variety of ways.
Great. Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Wyckoff? Thank you for participating in the work group.
Thank you.
Mr. Thornhill, I think it's your lucky day.
Thank you.
It's looking pretty good.
Thank you. Madam Chair Walker, Senators, for the record, my name is Robert Thornhill, and I live in Beaverton, Oregon. I appeared before you as a member of Veterans of Foreign Wars, post-1442, and the VFW Action Officer on this waiver. To be more precise, I'm here to thank the committee for this bill, and I hope my thanks not premature. But in doing so, I want you to know that I'm honored and privileged to speak for the comrades who accompanied me here today, plus the other 18,000 members of the Oregon Department of Veterans of Foreign War. First, I want to thank Chair Walker, and committee members for going out of your way to bring this matter before the special 2008 session. It would have been so easy to have simply put it off to the 2009 session or later, as some have advocated. However, there are individuals now eligible and presumably in need of the benefits provided by this bill. Moreover, the troops now deployed and soon to be deployed need the reassurance that if they become a casualty covered by this waiver program, a down payment has been made on the education of the members of their families. Second, I want to thank you for 1066-6 itself. I have often heard an old saying to the effect that making laws is like making sausage, and that one shouldn't want to watch either being made. Based on firsthand experience gained from this committee, I dispute that saying. We, the VFW, came to you with the germ of an idea, not very well formulated, and with lots and lots of blanks. We are soon, we hope, to realize a law providing much more than we had envisioned, all due to deliberations and the hard work under severe time constraints of this committee. Contrary to the old saying, and notwithstanding a couple of short periods of anxieties and bumps of the heart, it has been a pleasure to watch lawmaking in this case. And to continue with the sausage metaphor, we think we're about to have legislation that would be the envy of Jimmy Dean. Though not for us, we're grateful for you for doing this for Oregon men and women now in uniform and their families. We pray that the numbers who become eligible for this waiver program will forever remain small. However, in anticipation that the bill does become law, we in the VFW look forward to encouraging all eligible to take advantage of this program, not only for their own good, but for the good of Oregon and good for the good of the nation. I have read your newsletters to your constituents, and I hope that your newsletters in wrapping up the 2008 session will count this waiver program as one of its major achievements. I would also be remiss if I did not thank Committee Administrator Dana Richardson for the help she has provided me and the information she's given, and also for that anonymous person somewhere in the building that puts these things into the legalese that's administrable. And finally, thank you for the gracious welcome accorded me and my more mature buddies backing me up for this hearing. Thank you very much. And could I introduce my buddies real quick?
You may. Mr. Thornhill, please do.
Starting here, Marin Ellsworth. You met him before. He's our post commander. Al Rennigan, Chuck Connor, Korea, Vietnam, Jock Clocko, WW2, John Gullion, WW2, Dick Strand, WW2. We just celebrated Dick Brand's 91st birthday.
Wow.
George Brinfleck, WW2. And my old buddy George Winslow, and you can tell he's a Marine from Vietnam. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Senator Hass.
I just want to say, Robert, you're no slouch yourself. And I'm hoping maybe you could help me with my kindergarten bill next year.
All right. Thank you both. Ms. Wyckoff, I appreciate it. And Mr. Thornhill, you got the other side to work with, but just know Ms. Richardson is committee administrator for the House Education Committee as well, so they will be well-versed on that. So I think that takes care of the Dash 7. We've had all the people testify on that, so let's move to some of the other amendments that we've got. I got a little cheat sheet here. Let's see. What's the Dash 1? Remind me. Mr. Allen, let's get you up here because yours is very short to talk about TAG, and then Ms. Chamberlain will do your two amendments.
Thank you, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, again, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and I'll keep my remarks brief. We've talked about this a couple times before, but inadvertently, there is a statutory conflict in the way TAG dollars are allocated, and as you know, the department received an allocation of $350,000 off of the top of the state school fund to allocate towards TAG programs. The intention of the legislature was for the department to increase its 0.3 FTE to a full FTE for this biennium, and then to use the rest of the money to create regional TAG centers at some of our public colleges and universities. And the amendments accomplished that. And then briefly to comment on the fiscal impact statement, the bill, we made it very clear to the Legislative Fiscal Office, and I'm going to read from the agency fiscal impact statement form that we submitted and was reviewed by Adrian Sexton, who's now at our agency and spent almost a decade at the Legislative Fiscal Office. Now, just to quote, ODE is currently authorized to expend up to $350,000 of state school fund for TAG education, and the measure would allow administration and support costs to be spent from this allocation. So the narrative that we sent to LFL basically says, we already have the money, and here's how we're intending on spending it in this biennium. And then it also gives the committee a picture of the future costs of having that TAG staff person. I think when we had talked about it, we had sort of guesstimated around $160,000 or $165,000. And, you know, costs keep going up. It's penciled out to $172,000 out of that $350,000 during the next biennium. So we wanted to make sure that was included so the committee had the true picture of that cost going forward into the next biennium. So okay. It should not have a fiscal for us.
And we have no additional amendment. The bill as it stands satisfies.
That's That's correct.
Our issue. Okay, great. Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Allen? All right, terrific. Thank you, Mr. Allen. The anabolic steroids, I don't think we have anyone testifying on that, so that's the dash three.
Morgan can if you need him to.
Do you need to testify on that while you're there?
I think we're
briefly again, Morgan Allen, Department of Education. The steroids, Sasha from Senator Courtney's office and our staff of the department and some of the research folks at OHSU got together, and I think we've improved the bill and given more flexibility to the school districts and got OSAA in at the right place on providing training to coaches. So I think it improves the bill, and Senator Courtney was here in support of the amendment.
And
so
that's the dash three. Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Allen. Okay, now we're down to the last two amendments, 1 and 8. Ms. Chamberlain, you want to come up? 1, we've seen. 8's a new one. And she's just so lucky we were still not done with Senate bills.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Director of Teacher Standards and Practices. I think we have a situation for that exemplifies exactly why this session works. We recently discovered that we had been misinterpreting our fingerprint statute and not fingerprinting student-teacher candidates as frequently as the statute requires. And that's actually been an interpretation that's been in place for over 10 years. We've never discovered any ill effects. We just now discovered we were enforcing the statute incorrectly. So the statute requires that if a student teacher candidate from an Oregon program applies for an Oregon license and their fingerprints, they haven't been fingerprinted in the previous year, they have to resubmit fingerprints. And that really is unnecessary. They're continuously enrolled in their programs. We can background check them through LEDs. They, it's very rare, frankly, that they can complete their practicum and student teaching time in their program in less than a year. We figured about 20% of those folks actually make it under the year deadline. So, and if we have to enforce this now, it'll actually cost the agency. So by passing the amendment, you save the agency $130,000.
Well, not only save you, but save all those poor, starving graduate students, of which my son is one.
Right, $75, yeah. Yes. And so we have never had any ill effects in the 6 years I've been here, and I'm sure the 4 years before. So the amendment would let us do it the way we've been doing it.
It's,
yeah, 130,000. All right. Roughly. Well, I'll declare a potential conflict of interest because my son's a graduate student, and I'd probably end up having to pay the $75. all right. How did you discover this? You're just reading the statutes?
Last session, the state police asked to have the fingerprint statutes moved into our statutes, so we were reviewing them and looking at them more closely and go, oh, look, we're doing it wrong. So.
Oops. Okay. Any questions? And then the first aid card, we've already talked about, that's the dash one. So the dash eight is this, let's fix the problem, Bill. Okay. Great. There are no questions. I think we're good to go.
Let's rock and roll.
Yeah, we're ready to rock. Yoo-hoo! Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1066. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1066. Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1066.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1066. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move the dash three amendment to Senate Bill 1066.
Senator Cruz moves the dash three amendment to Senate Bill 1066. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move the dash seven amendment to Senate Bill 1066.
Senator Cruz moves the dash seven amendment to Senate Bill 1066. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move the dash eight amendment to Senate Bill 1066.
Senator Cruz moves the dash eight amendment to Senate Bill 1066. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1066 as amended and amended and amended and amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill. I think there was another amendment we wanted to stick in here.
Well, I was hoping we'd wait until you were in Rules Committee because I had two or three I wanted to
stick in. I bet you did. All right. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 1066 as fully amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any conversation about that? I want to say that I want to thank the freshman senator for his hard work on working this out for these young gentlemen who have now left the room, because I just think that's really pretty special what we were able to do.
I'm really glad we were able to get that. Thank you, Mark. That was good work.
Okay.
Okay, any other comments? Okay, let's take the roll now.
Senator Hatch?
Aye.
Senator Benford?
Aye.
Senator Morse?
Aye.
Senator
Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. Senate Bill 1066 is on its way to the floor. Thank you. And that's a very technical bill. I like to close, but Senator Hass, I'm going to carry this, and then I'm going to have you close so that you can make your comments. Okay? All right. Thank you. And Senator Musker has to leave, so we will move into our next bill after I close the work session on Senate Bill 1066. And put all our amendments together. Have they called me yet? Do we need to get in?
They should call over the first opportunity.
Okay. All right. Then that's for you. There's no one signed up to testify. Okay. I have to step out to go present my own bill in another hearing. So I'm going to turn the gavel over to Senator Cruz. And we don't have anyone to testify on either of these two bills, other than the people that we think should testify. So, Senator Cruz, I'm going to have you gather them all up and bring them forward, and I will be back after I've had my piece. So, thank you.
Thank you.
I'll send
you
the
material
again. But I'm sorry, we didn't send about 1059 first.
Want to do that
first? I
think
the buyers are here.
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1059.
Chuck Bennett.
Chuck, this floor is yours. Or maybe one of the chairs.
The buyers
want to come up, or... I mean, you're more than welcome at this point.
Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett, representing the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, this is, as you recall, your second hearing on this bill. During your first hearing, you requested information from the Molalla River School District regarding statistics involving their numbers of incoming and outgoing students under their transfer policy. Superintendent Wayne Koster has provided that information in the handout I'm giving you. Unfortunately, Superintendent Koster was unable to be here, so I agreed to put his information into the record as you requested. I also was asked to give you an update on what the situation is at the Molalla River School District and its review of its transfer policy. Ms. Chairman, at this point, the Molalla River School Board is undergoing an entire review of its full set of policies, which is a substantial undertaking for any school board, and one that has been in the works now for some bit of time, and one that, as you might imagine, when you're trying to deal with something this complex, has been set up in a series of planned policy review sessions. Unfortunately, the transfer policy has not come up yet. In fact, the school board, since you last met, has not met yet again, and won't meet again until Thursday night. The school board, through their superintendent, continues to believe that the transfer policy is a local district issue. But they are discussing and working through this issue. They understand the interest that this committee has and members of the legislature, certainly of the family involved in seeing their children allowed to transfer outside of the school district, which would be at this point, as I understand it, in violation of the district policy in advance of those requesting the transfer exhausting other options that are available to them, including inside district transfer to other other schools if it's more convenient. But that said, I don't want to suggest that there is not going to be a complete look at this and that there will be a review that takes a really close look at how this district relates to its nearby, its adjoining district, Silver Falls School District. I recall mentioning to you, I believe, during the last hearing, this issue's been in front of the legislature before. In the mid-80s, Representative Soa brought bills involving exactly this question going the opposite direction. Silver Falls was not allowing students to transfer north into Clackamas County and brought a bill to try to resolve that issue. These are very difficult issues for the legislature. The stories are compelling. They're compelling at the local level. They're not just compelling at the state level. Certainly from our organization's point of view, though, those closest to the problem are probably most appropriate to deal with the problem, certainly at this point until they've had an opportunity to go through their policy manual and that portion that relates to transfers. I'd be more than happy, or I'm sure Superintendent Koster or members of their board would be more than happy to continue to report to this committee throughout the interim on the progress they're making on working on this issue. Thank you.
Yeah. Questions? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck, would it be appropriate for the state to establish broad policy guidelines from which districts then could develop their own specific policies?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I think, you know, on the face of it, probably worthwhile talking about broad policy guidelines. I just don't know how broad and what they'd look like. I think it's the kind of thing we could certainly discuss. But, again, Senator Morrison, and I know you agree with me on this, these are tend to be local issues with districts being very different in their circumstance, whether they're declining enrollment, rapid growth, and the list of variables go on. And I can just think off the top, and a good example is Silver Falls, where they have a policy related to Molalla River. They're in the same, even in the same geographic area, allowing students to go to Molalla River. But unstated, really, at the other side of that, they're getting a substantial influx of students from the Salem School District as because Salem is growing so rapidly. So I'm not sure how you deal with the question. I it's one of those I think we could talk about. I'm just not sure what it looks like exactly in terms of dealing with broad policy questions involving transfer. You know, it's hard to kind of off the top of your head say because you don't know what, again, it looks like.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. If I might follow up. It seems to me that it would be appropriate to have broad policy guidelines because a family on one side of the district that's treated differently than a family on the other side of the district just inherently does not seem fair or equitable.
Yeah.
And to that extent, maybe there should be some overarching guidelines for school districts so that it's not a willy-nilly pick and choose based on the, you know, the circumstances of the moment, that they are a little more clear and objective rather than so subjective.
It'd certainly be worth it to bring in some example policies from districts. I think you will find that they are not I don't think you would characterize the policies you'd see from school districts as willy-nilly. They really do deal with educational issues, attempts to find balance between school districts' needs to stabilize their population and the needs of families and the requests of families to move along. But I think it could certainly be of value to all of us to take a look at that and see if there are some things that are missing. I can see what you're saying. We tend to, in the education community, be absolutely committed to local control, the belief that locally elected officials make the best local decisions. Sometimes having someone at least review local decisions is pretty helpful. Maybe somebody overlooks something, so we'd be glad to come in and talk about that.
If I might just have one follow-up, Mr. Chair. If you have a policy that essentially covers poor performance, if you have a school that really is underperforming, and children are locked into that school, that's not serving the interests of the students. It may be serving the interests of the district, but not the interest of the students. And so I'm not so sure what schools shouldn't be competitive. And they earn.
It's a great debate.
They earn those students.
Yeah, it's a great debate. I do think if you looked at the Molalla River School District policies, you'd find no student is locked into an underachieving school. They are able to do inside district transfers until you get to the high school level, where you begin running into a single school in the district. But the discussion of complete open enrollment statewide is one maybe we should have sometime, and just see how that would work and how we would fund that. These are interesting questions. I think we'd be glad to sit down because they're worth talking about.
Thank you. You know, Chuck, thank you for the data, but the data you brought us creates more questions than it answered.
Yeah.
And, for example, having the three-year run is also helpful. When you look back to 05, 06, when Molalla River had 84 outgoing, and now they're down to 37, so they have reached some equity there to some degree. But what I find more compelling is in every case for this school year where they have outgoing students, they have denial of outgoing students in every single case. And of course, the questions that arise is why, and we don't have that answer. And one would hope it's not a numbers game, but potentially it could be. And for small school districts, there is critical mass, and we know that. I am disinclined to killing that with a sledgehammer, and to a degree, that's where we're at with this, besides the fact that the chair doesn't want to pass the bill. But the chair and I have had a conversation, committee members, and we think an appropriate form of action at this point in time might be to write a letter from the committee to the Molalla River School District expressing our concern and our interest and with hoping that we can have resolution to this particular case and also expressing our interest in the subject into the future. Because quite honestly, fixing Molalla River doesn't fix the system. And I've never been one to do point-specific legislation. I've rejected that in the past, and I have to be consistent on some things. And it is a bigger issue, and clearly not one that we can probably solve in the next half hour. So we will, with the concurrence of the committee, we will draft a letter to the district, and that will be our form of action at this point in time. Really, I think it's appropriate and probably the best we can do in this short term. But Senator Morris, I think you're right. It is a bigger discussion, and it does need to happen. And we can put it on the agenda for a session where we actually have time to get into issues. So that would be a good agenda item for 09. So
Thank you very
much,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, and we will make that happen. So, did you want to say anything, Roger? Okay. Good to see you. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1059, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1097. Is Senator Farioli close?
He's being gotten. Would you like me to introduce
him? Yeah. Dana, would you talk about the bill for a minute while the senator and others are coming up?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1097 establishes the Oregon Professional Development Initiative Commission in the Department of Education. It provides for commission membership and the executive director appointment. It charges the commission to develop statewide, research-based, sustainable, high-quality professional development system. It charges the commission to provide professional development resources and curricula, as well as a virtual learning network. It requires the commission to report annually to the State Board of Education, the Joint Boards of Education, and the Legislative Assembly. It appropriates monies and declares an emergency would be effective upon passage. It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Jim, would you and Sue like to join Ted at the dais? Or we all let him do it and then you'll come up? Okay, we'll do that. Senator Farioli, good to see you. How are you doing?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. I'm doing quite well. And nice to see you there with the gavel, Mr. Chair. Senator Ted Farioli, for the record. Mr. Chairman, what the committee staff is distributing is a couple of pages from a report that was published very recently called Quality Counts 2008. It's from Education Weekly magazine. It's a supplement to that publication. I hold it up for your reference. You will note that on page 2, Oregon has received a series of grades in a whole several different categories of quality under the Quality Counts grading summary for chance of success for Oregon students, a C, for K-12 achievement, a D, for standards assessment and accountability, a C+, for transitions and alignments, a D, for school finance, a C-, and for the teaching profession, which is professional development, an F. This is a disaster, in my opinion, for Oregon students, because it isn't that Oregon doesn't have great teachers. We do have great teachers in Oregon. They're dedicated professionals, and they care about our kids. And it isn't that we don't have professional development training courses in Oregon. We do have. They are an expenditure of time and resources and money and energy. Unfortunately, they are, in fact, utterly uncoordinated. So there's no system of professional development that is transparent, that is measurable, that develops and delivers a well-defined outcome, and that parents and patrons and teachers and administrators can look at and determine what it is that they're supposed to focus on in terms of professional development for coursework and for teacher competency. So the problem is, in fact, the lack of the system. We have also teachers in rural areas that have no assurance that they have access to quality professional development programs, and no way to determine that the dollars that we are spending on professional development currently are making a difference in the classroom. And that is the key issue here. Whether or not a highly qualified teacher in the target subject area is in the classroom makes all the difference to class functioning and to performance in the classroom. This bill assures that quality courses and access to information will be available to all Oregon educators. It assures that the money school districts currently spend and will spend on teacher development will be spent and used for the best possible educational professional development program. Simply put, it requires the Department of Education to adopt a system of standards for professional development courses offered and to implement a virtual network that makes courses, resources, and research available to all educators in our state. In other words, really does impose a systematic approach to professional development. It does not do a number of things. It does not indict teachers. You know, it isn't against the education profession or against the professionals that teach our children. It isn't about a criticism of associations or private providers or schools or school district administrators or any of that other stuff. It really is only about developing a system for success that is transparent, that delivers a measurable to parents and to patrons and to students, that allows for citizens to track that progress, and that clearly defines what the training program will be in the state of Oregon. And so far we do not have that. It does not take local control away. It does not dictate to educators and school districts how they should implement, or nor does it charge them for implementation. And it really doesn't change where educators go for their courses, association workshops, regional seminars, or community colleges. The role of the commission is simply to do four things: to develop and create the statewide research-based, high-quality, sustainable professional development system, to establish statewide standards based on nationally recognized staff development standards that are linked to increasing student achievement. So you've got a continuous improvement component. Three, to provide professional development resources and curricula that are based on data research and best practices. And four, to establish a virtual learning network for teachers, administrators, assistants, educational assistants that provide resources to support the school districts as they implement the development of this professional development program. Finally, this isn't a matter of stepping into the function of the Teachers Standards and Practices Commission. It isn't about taking an authority or a prerogative away from anyone, but it is about developing a system that we believe will turn that F into an acceptable passing grade. So it's about continuous improvement, and it's really about empowerment, using some of the resources that we have and a few additional resources to get this recognition that instead of denial, which is where I find the Department of Education now, when I had a conversation with representatives of the Department of Education, they spent a half an hour telling me how the methodology of the report was flawed. You know, I tried the same thing when I brought an F home from Grant High School to my parents. It wasn't a very successful conversation. You know, the teacher didn't like me. The subject is boring. You know, I had sports practice, you know, and I didn't get enough sleep. Whatever. You got an F, you have to, there's remediation. You know, this is the time for us to embrace the F, own it, and say, you know, we can do better, and we must do better. And the mechanism to do better is a very easily adopted system of standard professional development based on the kind of data and the kind of standards that exist elsewhere in places where they don't get an F for professional development from Education Weekly. This bill would cost some money. There are lottery dollars for to the tune of $400,000 per year. And that's for the biennia. It would be matched by equal dollars from the private sector or public grant funds. The bottom line is that would assure us that the $100 million that we invest in teacher professional training is actually invested in something that has measurables, that's transparent, that everyone can buy into, and that is available throughout the state of Oregon. You know, I've looked really hard. I can't find anything wrong with this bill, notwithstanding the fact that I proposed it. And even, you know, to my shock and amazement, the editorial in the Oregonian today says that it's really time to adopt this kind of a program. You very rarely get a chance to spend 50 cent dollars. This is your opportunity, because this is matched by private contribution. So I would tell you that We had a colleague we all served with, it was Senator Harper, Steve Harper, and I came in and he was sitting at his desk one day and he had his head in his hands and I said, what can be the matter, Colonel Harper? And he said, well, I'm, for the first time in my legislative career, I occupy the moral high ground and I've been having nosebleeds. So I've been feeling like, after reading the editorial in the Oregonian, that my nose is bleeding. But this is the moral high ground. It's time to institute, you know, a change. Let's embrace the F. Let's learn from it. Let's move forward and do better. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions? Thank you, Mr. Chair, for recognizing me. Thank you, Senator Farrell, for bringing this forward. You passed over a number, and I thought I caught it correctly. And the first time I heard this number, it was in the vernacular of Senator Johnson. It was a jaw dropper. You've all heard her use that term. $150 million that we spend. Did I hear that number correctly? On
Mr. Chairman,
in-service training,
Senator Morse, it's well over 100 million. It's well over 100 million. It could be approaching 150. Mr. Chairman, the point is that if you really decided to get tough on a percentage basis, it's probably not enough money. You're looking at a multiple billion-dollar enterprise plus $8 billion. So, you know, as a percentage of the $8 billion, if that's what you're spending on professional development, it may not be enough. Point is, every dollar is precious, and every dollar ought to be spent in a programmatic fashion. The real important thing is that we've got people doing all sorts of creative stuff for professional development, but it isn't connected with an outcome that is transparent and measurable. Now, I don't want to over-bureaucratize the system that's already pretty bureaucratic. The point is, parents ought to be able to see that, and teachers ought to be able to know that they're going to invest their time in a professional development program that has an outcome that they're proud of. An F is not something you want to take home and show mom and dad, or in this case, the district patrons and the school district administrators and the superintendent.
To follow up, Mr. Chair, I'd like to challenge you on one aspect of the assumptions. If we're investing, is that $150 million per biennium?
I think it is per biennium.
Per biennium. Okay, if we're investing that, that's no small sum of money.
No, it's not.
And if, from those that are receiving the training, they don't think that it's, they're not satisfied. You know, the teaching profession is not satisfied. My business mind says, I'm not going to throw more money at it. I'm going to redirect $150 million to change that from an F to at least a high-performing grade. And I think we fall too often into, if we have a problem, let's throw more money at it. I think we need to first look at how do we redirect the existing resources so that they are used more effectively.
Mr. Chairman, if I could answer that. I don't disagree with your premise. I just would like to point one other thing out. On any individual professional development opportunity, every one of the teachers and professionals that goes to one of those training opportunities is asked to evaluate the opportunity after it. You know, we all do the little checklist and the little comment form. I will tell you that almost all of those comment forms are used to make that training session better and better. So in a dozen different venues all across the state of Oregon, you have absolutely wonderful and perfectly uncoordinated training going on. And each individual training seminar will produce a record of excellence. Oh, my gosh, it was fun. It was entertaining. You know, we learned a lot. I feel energized, blah, blah, blah. The bottom line is, how is that connected to student performance? How is that connected to the data that shows train your teachers in this methodology and the grades go up or the comprehension improves? That's the missing link here. And what we're saying is don't grab that $100 million and run off somewhere and spend it elsewhere, because it probably needs to be spent on professional development. What we're saying is find a mechanism where a small expenditure of public resources, in this case $400,000, will develop a methodology so that you get the value of the $100 million-plus dollar investment. So we're really talking about getting the value.
Thank you. I think you're on to something here, Senator. I think it's not a bad idea and something we should look at. But just to get more theoretical, I guess, if you do, some of that training is something that would be difficult to quantify down the road. You go to this training, and next year the kids start getting better grades. Some of it's motivational. Some of it's dealing with a small group of students, I'm not sure how, if you could, you would be able to connect those dots.
Mr. Chairman, that's an excellent observation and an excellent question. Part of what this bill does is it creates a group of people to sit down and look at what kind of training we're doing. The commission's role, in fact, is to take a look at what's out there, and do an analysis on how the training is being delivered. And at the most basic level, we connect classroom instruction with state-approved curriculum. We're not doing it with teacher training. It's just the most basic scheme. So, even though it is a job that may be difficult at this end to look at, if you think about what four things we're asking that commission to do, to develop a program that is statewide, research-based, sustainable, high quality, to establish the statewide standards based on nationally recognized staff development standards, which we don't impose currently, and then to provide a coordinating curricula to deliver that. I think those three things are exactly what you're after. They actually do connect the dots for us. And it's leverage. It's a little bit of money with an influx of private dollars to provide a regulatory mechanism or a regulating mechanism to deliver the product that we all really want for kids, which is better qualified professionals in the classroom.
Any other questions? I'd also point out, Senator, that another measurement might be the fact that the turnover rate for new teachers would decline as well.
It could. What is it, 1 in 5 leaves in the first couple of years? It's not a good record. And Mr. Chairman, I don't mean to be facetious here. It isn't about the F. It's about providing excellence in the classroom. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Jim, you want to come? Oh, okay.
I'll let, if you don't mind, Senator, Sue will start off and then
sure.
We'll just
absolutely.
Kind of turn in. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sue Hildick. I'm president of the Chalkboard Project, and I want to take you back 2 weeks ago. Chalkboard worked with COSA to sponsor a conference for Oregon superintendents, and we brought in Dr. Karen Holly Miles from the Harvard School of Education to talk about school organization. And she made a statement that has really stuck with me. She told the audience that investing in teacher quality through professional development has 5 times the effect on increasing student achievement than any other school improvement strategy. And she specifically named lowering class size by 1 student at a time as an example of one of those strategies. 5 times the effect on student achievement. That's why Chalkboard is here, and that's why we're spending so much time on the teacher quality issues. And I have to tell you, after almost 4 years' work, teacher quality has become really the cornerstone of our research and the efforts that we're engaged in. And that's why we're so thrilled you put the mentor program back in place last session for new teachers. That's why we brought a professional development bill to the 07 session. And that's why we're here today. We're concerned that Oregon isn't doing enough, and we're most concerned that teachers are telling telling us Oregon isn't doing enough. And so we hope to work with all the stakeholders in this room and at this panel to bring you an even better, more comprehensive proposal in the 2009 session. We really want to commend Senator Farioli for the work he's already done in recognizing the importance of the issue and bringing something forward in this session. But we think there's a broader conversation to be had before we're ready to decide on what the most strategic interventions can be. So we expect to be back in 2009 again with a bill on this topic and hope that it's a much more comprehensive solution.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Courtney Vandersteck, and I'm the Assistant Executive Director for the Oregon Education Association. My little piece of OEA's pie is our Center for Teaching and Learning, and this is a topic near and dear to my heart. As Ms. Hildick has mentioned, we are working together to bring you a broader, deeper proposal, I believe, than the one that was brought up last session. Chalkboard and the OEA are partnering to do a more in-depth survey of exactly what our teacher needs in the current realm of schooling for all students. The needs are changing daily. And so we look forward to continued work with the broad group of stakeholders to bring a proposal that will really have an impact beyond good intentions to really make a difference in professional development for all educators and therefore in the success rate of all students. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Chair, Chuck Bennett with Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. The two previous speakers, I think, have done a very good job of describing what our plans are for 2009 and the amount of work that's going into creating a comprehensive discussion of professional development and what can be done there. We at COSA are very interested in it. The thing we've learned over the years with professional development is how individualized and localized it is, almost a school-by-school discussion. And it's exciting to have a chance to talk about it. We think at that level, professional administrators, teachers, aides, all school employees have an opportunity to participate in quality professional development. It'll be a very exciting discussion next session, and it'll be interesting to see what we can bring to you from this point. Thank you.
For the record, James Sager, Governor's Office. And just to make it clear that we're not putting this off, I want you to know we're working right now to confirm either March 11th or 12th as our next meeting. And this broad coalition, as has been mentioned, consists of not only members here, but members representing the post-secondary education system, members of the legislature and others who are intimately involved in all the aspects. And so one of the pieces that some homework that was given to members of the committee was to go out and be able to come back to the group and talk about all the efforts that are going on currently out there that obviously as legislators it would be hard for you to know. It's even difficult for us sometimes to kind of keep up with it. And so that way we can make sure that we're not recreating the wheel, but in fact actually putting proposal before you that's going to help our education community and most importantly deliver the best product for students. So thank you.
I'd be clear that to determine where you're going, you got to know where you are, obviously. Senator Morris, you look like you have a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to relate this whole issue to my own personal experience in what we did in our business. I think we're a little bit unusual in that we set a policy with respect to the percentage of our payroll that we dedicated to training and education. And we led our industry, and I think we led probably most of the industries in the state. And maybe that's where we need to be thinking in terms of what percentage of the payroll dollar do we want to, on an ongoing basis, put into professional development through training and education. And I come back to the $150 million. I suspect that if you were to take that number
and apply it as a percent of payroll, it would be a fairly high, probably, I would guess, probably in that 3-4% range. And I see, sir, you're nodding your head, which by the standards that I come from would be a high number. We allocated 3% and had outstanding results. I mean, the return is tremendous. But
Mr. Chair, if I may, Senator Morse, I passed out, and I hope you've got it, some 10 key findings around professional development. If you look on the back, there's one about the amount and of the size of the enterprise, and we've estimated it's about $130 million a year, not a biennium, a year, which is 3%. In fact, when we went into our look, we thought maybe one of the solutions was a set-aside, much like Minnesota has. They have 2% of their state school fund, which is spent on professional development. We were a little surprised to find that ours is bigger than that.
Which, if I may follow up, it gets back to the thinking, instead of new money, redirecting and more effective use of existing funds. And I think that's what the public really would expect us to do.
Additional questions?
Well, obviously, we are not moving this bill because it wasn't scheduled for work session. So we can. I clearly support the concept, and I'm looking forward to the work of your group, Jim. This is critical, important work, and we are here to assist as well. You know, when Senator, well, I have the gavel. When Senator Walker and I talked about the February session early on, we realized that for the most part, although we've done some good work, mm-hmm. for the most part, the issues in education are a lot bigger than we could deal with during this session. This clearly is one of them. I'm expecting us to have, well, those of us that are still here, I gotta be careful here, don't I?
Yeah.
I'm up for re-election, so I may not be here. But anyway, we're going to have a very full plate, and this committee is going to be rocking and rolling in 09. And
why are you looking at me?
You're here. You, my sense is, Senator Hass, you'll be part of this committee ongoing. So, I mean, this is a special interest of yours, and that would be appropriate. So, anyway, I'm glad we got this on the record, and I'm looking forward to the work. And let's forge ahead. And with that, I'll turn the gavel back over to the chair before I...
Oh, I was going to call you Mr. Chair, so don't do that just yet,
Chair. Okay. Well, do you have a question or comment, Senator Walker?
No, I'm sorry I missed all of your testimony. I heard most of it, but I appreciate that you're all wanting to go, and we're going to get something in 09. Sometimes things just take a little bit longer, and we have kindergarten to work with. We have this to work with. Those are very two big pieces of the education agenda that we've got to take care of in 09, and I think there are some funding formula issues involved in that, which also is very complex. So I think this committee is we've done very good work in 08, and we're looking forward to working with all of you in 09. And while the committee may change a little, I think the tenor of the committee is still the same. We're very dedicated to helping elevate Oregon's education system back to an A. In fact, I'd like an A-plus on there, if you don't mind. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. And with that, I will close the public hearing on 1070 or 1097. And seeing no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
And I wonder if there